This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It's been 1 year since victorious Republicans chose Newt Gingrich to be Speaker of the House, the first Republican in that position in 4 decades. But he's now the target of investigations. Today, the House Ethics Committee debated the scope of their probe. The Federal Election Commission, the FEC, has filed a civil suit against GOPAC, a political action committee that Gingrich headed from 1986 until last May. GOPAC was founded in 1979 to help elect Republicans in local and state elections. Under Gingrich, the mission changed to elect a Republican-controlled House of Representatives. The Federal Election Commission suit charges that before GOPAC registered as a national PAC in 1991, it violated federal election laws by contributing to the campaigns of national candidates, including Gingrich. Last week, the FEC made public over 5,000 pages of GOPAC memos and transcripts. My guest, Stephen Engelberg, is an investigative reporter for The New York Times. He says these GOPAC papers tell a behind-the-scenes story of the creation of the so-called Republican Revolution.
I think the documents are absolutely fascinating. It's 5,000 pages of internal memos and, more importantly, tape-recorded and transcribed transcripts of GOPAC meetings going back to 1988, 89, 90, at a time when Newt Gingrich was just becoming the whip, the sort of Republican senior member of the House. And what we see in these documents is a group of people with a vision and a question. Their question is, why and how could it be that the Republican Party has a substantial advantage in fundraising, and it's winning the presidential elections handily? I mean, we all remember, the Reagan triumph in 1984, an astounding sort of, just defeat of Mondale. And yet, in each one of these elections, they get no closer to controlling the House. Some years they even fall behind, even as they're winning the national elections. And the Senate is really quite an elusive target, sort of slides back and forth for them. So that's what they began with. The question was, why are we losing? How can we create a Republican majority in the House and the Senate, and therefore take control of Congress? And so we see the beginnings of a revolution, and we were able to sort of listen to the leaders, if you will, talking about how they conceived of what they were going to do and what their tactics would be and what their strategy was.
Newt Gingrich became the head of GOPAC in 1986. Was he the main force behind this change of focus in GOPAC, changing the focus to having a Republican majority in the House?
Very much so. I mean, I think one of the things that becomes clear, and there will, I'm sure, be Gingrich biographies over the next many years. Historians will look at him as an important figure. And one of the things the documents makes very clear is the sort of primacy of Newt Gingrich in any kind of gathering that he sort of presides over. He is an idea man. He kind of sits in these meetings and throws out 10 ideas at once. Some of them are good. Some of them are clearly not kind of wacky. But at the end of the day, he is the sort of energetic driving force in GOPAC.
What are some of the things that he called for in GOPAC in the early stages of the Republican Revolution?
Well, they had a vision. I mean, they after 1988, when they actually went down, not up, in the number of House seats, they kind of regrouped and said, all right, what is it we're going to have to do here? How do we do this? And the concept from the beginning and forward had always been, the first thing we need to do is have a farm team. We have to create these young activists in the state and local seats who can eventually run for Congress. And that was clearly not all that they needed to do. Because that wasn't working. They weren't getting anywhere. And his first insight, I think, was that one needed to have a national message for congressional candidates. Because I think one of the answers to the question, why do the Republicans keep losing in the House, was that the Democrats were very successful in making each congressional election a referendum on an incumbent, on a local guy who did constituent service and was familiar and had built up a network of contacts and grassroots support. And as long as Democrats could do that, plus the advantages of being able to send out mail, the congressman had this franking privilege, the advantages of being able to raise more money from PACs because PACs like to give to people in power, all of that sort of kept the Democrats with a lock on the House. So the first point was, okay, we're not going to be able to outdo them in those ways. What can we do? Well, we can have a national message, and we can tailor that message to issues that we know people care about. And so that's the first insight.
Well, that message later became the contract with America. What were the formative stages of that contract?
Well, it comes at exactly this point. As they begin to talk about how are we going to have a national message, Gingrich and his colleagues begin to discuss the notion of what they called in those days an agenda worth voting for. The name later changed. But the idea, and this was as early as 1989, and the documents indicate it may even have been earlier, but certainly that's the first mention that the FEC has of it, is a 100-day agenda of items that everybody, would feel comfortable with, or the majority of people would feel comfortable with. And it's very interesting, I believe, when you read these debates, how, in a sense, unideological the conversation is. Because I think one tends to perceive the Republican Revolution of 1994, because of the people who were elected with it, as a kind of very, strongly, even radically conservative set. But in the planning stages, what you see is a search for ideas that is really more of a center-right coalition. At one point in one of the memos, somebody writes, as we put together this agenda, abortion's off the table, too divisive. And they are looking for things that they believe can be tested through focus groups and will be just automatically popular. A balanced budget amendment the balanced budget issue is mentioned. They mention other things which, never came to be. Perhaps the later focus group testing, showed them to be not as popular as they hoped. I mean, one early document talked about, education vouchers, making the collapse of infrastructure in American cities a big issue. Health care was on the list back in 1989 of things that they might want to talk about. And we now know that the contract with America was, in fact, developed through extensive polling and focus group testing. They picked, other issues, kept the balanced budget one, but otherwise picked other issues. But the sort of approach, the tactic was the same. Make the congressional election national. If you can do that and you can put together a nationally attractive platform, you will do better.
The contract with America seemed to really strike a chord, right? It got a lot of attention, and it certainly seemed to help the Republicans win a majority in the House. How come it didn't fly? How come its early version didn't fly in 1989?
Well, they were looking to the 1992 election. That was the idea. They called the 1989 sort of document the 3-year plan, which is somewhat similar to the 5- and 10-year plans the Soviets used to try. And the 3-year plan was that in 1992, as they envisaged it, George Bush would be running for re-election. They believed that Bush would be popular. They didn't understand, and who would necessarily, that there would be a Gulf War followed by a great decline in Bush's popularity. So they thought they would have an incumbent president. They thought that they could get the president to endorse this agenda worth voting for, and between him and them, they would run out all together, and the president would sort of pull them into power. He would be saying, these are the programs that I'm going to enact when my friends in the Republicans in the House have a victory. This didn't happen. As far as we can deduce it, and we did interview some people, with the Bush campaign and with GOPAC, primarily because the Bush people didn't want to do it.
Why not?
Well, the documents make fairly clear that Gingrich's view of the White House and of Bush was sort of thinly veiled, thinly barely concealed contempt. I think that Gingrich and his ilk at this time saw Bush and the White House as largely the embodiment of everything they thought was wrong with the Republican Party, which is that it was sort of about good government, about moderate solutions to moderate problems. They saw, and this is not explicit but implicit in the documents, I believe they saw Bush as being wholly without ideas, a sort of, and in this I think they may have had a point. I mean, they may have picked on something that the electorate saw as well. And in any event, there was bad blood between Bush and Gingrich. In 1990, there had been the budget and tax deal where Bush had reluctantly agreed to raise taxes to solve the budget crisis. And Gingrich had been part of the negotiating team that agreed to all of this, and then he kind of backed away from it afterward. And we are told Bush basically never forgave him for that, found that to be just the height of betrayal. And so the notion that Bush and Gingrich were going to unite around an agenda was probably unlikely or became increasingly unlikely in the early 1990s. And the Bush people told us that there was really no great desire to do this because, oddly enough, in September of 1992, Gingrich tried to organize exactly the same kind of event that he organized in September of 1994 to unveil the contract with America, which was to assemble all the candidates on the steps of the Capitol and put up a big sign and have a press conference and say, this is our agenda. And the Bush people were having nothing of it, and even believed, as Robert Teeter, the campaign chairman, told us, that this might be a negative for Bush. This might not work out. And I think what he meant by that was that this would be perceived as radical, sort of right-wing, factionalism, and it would not appeal to the broader range of voters.
Documents that the Federal Election Commission released show that there were some GOPAC officials who were quietly talking about recruiting sympathetic Republicans to infiltrate the Republican Platform Committee. What did you learn about that by reading the document?
Well, this is 1992. One of the concerns that GOPAC and Gingrich's people had as they were planning the three-year agenda to culminate in 1992, they weren't sure that Bush was going to go along. And they decided that perhaps one way to deal with that, and this is in an early document, would be to force his hand, to make the platform their agenda worth voting for, and therefore Bush would have no real choice. And so they talk about the notion in the documents of, well, maybe we could go out and find people who believe in our agenda to run for the platform committee, and in that way, Bush doesn't have much of a choice. Now, there was a woman who wrote a memo about all of this, and when she sent it to a friend, she referred to this part of the program as phase two, and she said, well, phase two is the equivalent of high treason, so please tear up the document when you are done. Fortunately for history, the fellow didn't tear up the document, and so it later appeared in the files and it was available for discovery by the FEC. It's interesting that in a later iteration of that document, just a few weeks later, she is told by a superior to edit out the references to the platform committee, which she does, and the typed version of that document does not include any mention of this.
Stephen Engelberg is my guest, an investigative reporter based in Washington for the New York Times. Let's take a short break, and then we'll continue this story of GOPAC. This is Fresh Air. Back with Stephen Engelberg, he's an investigative reporter for the New York Times based in Washington. The Federal Election Commission is investigating GOPAC, a political action committee formerly headed by Newt Gingrich. The FEC released a lot of related documents last week. Stephen Engelberg co-wrote an article in the New York Times about those documents, and he says these documents really reveal a lot about the architecture of the so-called Republican Revolution. Now, GOPAC trained a lot of candidates, and you point out in the article that a third of the 73 new House members received some training from GOPAC. What kind of training was this?
Well, they did different things. They had videotapes of how to present a message. They had audio tapes, which candidates could play in their car, which talked about tactics and strategy. They had workshops for candidates. And it's interesting because the focal point, in a sense, of the FEC complaint is about support to federal candidates, and one thinks, therefore, immediately that they gave money. The support we're talking about is really of a different sort. It's really, as Gingrich said at one point, we're the Bell Laboratories of the Republican Party. It's really kind of planning and research and formulating a message and how do you present that message. The tapes are quite striking. They, in some senses, sound like Gingrich. I mean, they are, in a sense, an attempt to take the political methodology that Gingrich had evolved of being assertive and very forward and, very openly associated with certain kind of issues and make them national.
Is the Federal Election Committee investigating GOPAC's training of candidates who were elected to the House?
The problem for the Federal Election Commission relates to the period before 1991, before GOPAC registered. And
before it registered as a PAC.
That's right, as a federal committee. And the issue is, although they said that they were doing state and local elections predominantly, although they said they were not really helping federal candidates, were they in fact doing so? One of the things that's in the documents is reference to the importance of supporting Newt. And one document refers to some $250,000 in 1990 that they define as Newt support. Now, from GOPAC's perspective, that's probably a very unfortunate way of characterizing whatever they did, because the judge in the case in Washington, the federal district judge, has set a very difficult standard for the FEC to meet in bringing this civil action. They have to show that not only that GOPAC generally aided federal candidates. GOPAC's very open about this. They say our goal was to make the House Republican. That's a general goal. But they say specifically we did so by helping the state and local guys to create this kind of roster of potential candidates. That's all fine, or at least the judge seems to think so. But what wouldn't be fine would be specific support to specific federal candidates before you were registered as federal. And so this reference to $250,000 in Newt support in 1990, a year in which Mr. Gingrich almost lost his seat, came within several hundred votes of losing his seat in Georgia. That could be a problem for GOPAC, because there you have a suggestion of specific support to a specific candidate, Mr. Gingrich. And that's about as close, at least that I've seen, that you come in the documents to find support for a specific candidate.
Now, I believe another document showed that GOPAC paid the salary and travel expenses of political consultants whose job was to, quote, help Newt think.
That's right. But now what Mr. Gingrich would say to some of this, I suspect, is, well, yes, of course. What I was thinking about was electing a Republican Congress, and that was our goal here. And we are most certainly permitted to have that goal. And he would say, yes, of course I had consultants who helped me think, and that was what we had GOPAC to raise money for. But so what? It doesn't mean that we were specifically supporting a federal candidate in violation of the law. And one thing to put in perspective here is, what are we really? We are not really talking about, this is not a criminal case. This is a civil action. This is the Federal Election Commission, which is examining a possible violation of election law. And no one's going to go to jail over this. Apparently, the FEC, according to Mr. Gingrich, had proposed that the case be settled by having GOPAC pay a $150,000 fine. Mr. Gingrich and GOPAC have chosen to fight, which is probably costing them more than $150,000 in legal fees, but I guess they feel that they have a chance of prevailing. Now, there is a public policy issue here, which is not trivial, and that is that in the period before they registered, GOPAC was able to raise money from a variety of people around the country and not disclose who gave how much. And the whole foundation of our federal election system is disclosure. Make it transparent. Let people know who's giving what, and we can then make our own judgments about who's influencing the agenda through the donation of money.
Newt Gingrich resigned from his position as the head of GOPAC this past May. How has GOPAC changed, and do you know why he resigned?
The sense I have is that there was a lot of opportunities for negative press for him. I mean, I think he foresaw that the FEC suit was not going to go away. He foresaw that GOPAC was going to, now that he was Speaker, get looked at ever more deeply. And I think Gingrich believed that separating himself from this was a wise move from a public relations standpoint. My understanding, I haven't really looked deeply at this, but my understanding is that GOPAC has continued to raise more and more money and become even more of a force within the Republican Party, since, of course, it's still associated with Gingrich and his people. And I would imagine that in the 1996 elections, they're going to play an important role in figuring out what the Republicans do, how they do it, and what the message is, and all the rest of that.
There's a Federal Elections Commission investigation of GOPAC. The House Ethics Committee is looking at Newt Gingrich. What effect do you think these investigations might have on Newt Gingrich's political career and his power now in Congress?
Of course, that's very difficult to say, because we don't know what they're going to find. We go back to the Jim Wright story. Newt Gingrich files charges against the powerful Speaker. Newt Gingrich is then a fairly minor, shrill backbencher. The charges, by and large, are sloppily put together, and it doesn't end up being, in large part, what eventually brings Wright down. But it's enough to get a special counsel looking at Wright, a very professional investigator with subpoena power. And when he got done, he found things nobody had ever heard of, and Jim Wright was the former Speaker. I think it's always dangerous for any politician when somebody with broad-ranging subpoena power can get after their dirty laundry. Bill Clinton cannot be happy that we have a special counsel looking at the Whitewater matter. And I think the thing to look for in the House Ethics Committee decisions, and remember the House Ethics Committee, of course, is still part of Republican Congress, and so it gets a little bit tricky. If the House Ethics Committee appoints a special counsel, that is potentially a problem for Mr. Gingrich, depending on what else is out there. And we won't really be able to know, you know, for many months what this really means. My guess is that at the end of the day, they're probably, if we stick to the charges as they're known now, the various charges that were before the House Ethics Committee or the GOPAC investigation by the Federal Elections Commission, he will not be vastly damaged. I would not want to be so arrogant as to suggest we know everything there is to be known at this point.
Stephen Engelberg, thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Stephen Engelberg is an investigative reporter for The New York Times. We spoke earlier today. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.